You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest looks at who makes the big political donations in the United States, how they match up with the public at large, and the differences they make on public policy. First, there's plenty of attention on House Republicans' proposed bill to replace the Affordable Care Act, but another health-related bill is making its way through Congress with less fanfare. But if passed, it could lead to a big change at many workplaces. H.R. 1313 is a bill that would allow companies to ask their employees to undergo genetic testing and supply that information to the employer, and if the employees choose not to comply, they would risk paying a penalty of up to thousands of dollars. In House committee last week, all 22 Republicans supported the bill, 17 Democrats opposed it. Sharon Begley joins us now. She's a senior science writer at STAT. Sharon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, I gave a very nutshell version of this genetic testing bill. Can you spell out for us how it would work?
Sure. This is all within the context of what are called workplace wellness programs. And these are things that employers have been offering more and more, and they range from the, you know, non-controversial, such as healthier food in the company cafeteria, maybe on-premises flu shots at the beginning of flu season. But they also go further in many cases, requiring employees to have blood draws and other so-called biometric tests to participate in weight loss programs and things like that. So the bill that's moving through Congress says that if an employee is covered by one of these workplace wellness programs and is asked to provide genetic information, that employee must do so, supply it to the employer. There's no provision for aggregating the data. In other words, it would be absolutely possible to identify the individual. You might ask, well, who would want this? And the answer is that at least some employers, especially large ones, are just looking for anything they can learn about their employees.
Right. And the notion, again, this is under a wellness plan. So currently the company could get my cholesterol tested, for example, right? It's that kind of information?
That's right. And the key thing is that that has to be voluntary. But that, of course, has caused a whole lot of debate because the programs generally penalize people who choose not to participate, usually some percentage of their health care premiums, sometimes deductibles, copays, et cetera. So under the proposed bill, the penalties that someone who chooses not to participate, declines to provide genetic information, could easily run into the $5,000 range or more.
And you asked the question, who would want this? Have we seen lobbying? Are there corporate groups or businesses making the case for allowing this more or less required genetic testing?
So I asked that, it's not completely clear. The fingerprints are not obvious. However, one group called the American Benefits Council, which is a group of mostly large Fortune 500 kind of companies, did testify in favor of it. A similar bill was introduced in the previous Congress, so they have tried this before, and that was supported by the Business Roundtable, again, a group of very large American corporations. And the reason seems to be that they are just looking for lots of ways that they can claw back some of the healthcare spending that they already do on employees. So if they can, you know, ding you by $500 a month because you choose not to participate, that money all goes to their bottom line.
We're talking to Sharon Begley, senior science writer at STAT, about a bill before the U.S. House making its way through there that would allow companies to say, hey, as part of our wellness program, you have to provide genetic material to us. You can voluntarily choose not to do it, but it could cost you thousands of dollars. You could be docked health care expenses, health insurance expenses, that kind of thing. What, Sharon, kind of concerns have been raised about this proposal?
Well, the most obvious ones, of course, are the privacy considerations. The landmark bill called GINA, G-I-N-A, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that finally passed in 2008. And people thought that meant that if they underwent genetic testing, you know, through a company like 23andMe, their employer could never access that information. But this new bill says that even if you don't want to or choose not to have the employer's wellness program collect, you know, do the cheek swab, the employer would have the right to say, if you have undergone genetic testing on your own we have the right to see that information. So, again, genetic privacy is a concern. But I talk to a lot of scientists who do genetics research, and they are just terrified that if this bill becomes law, and even as it's written about, that people who might otherwise be willing to participate in studies, you know, to advance scientific understanding, and are told by the researchers, don't worry, the information we collect on you for our research will never see the light of day. No, your employer can never ask for it. No one will ever see it. Well, if this bill goes through, that is all out the window. So a number of scientists I spoke to said they are just tearing their hair out at the message that's now being sent, that people who, for altruistic reasons, choose to volunteer for genetics research, they might not any longer have the protections that they thought they had.
Let's talk about the privacy angle. As I understand it, technically, if I'm in this wellness program, I supply that information. Within the company, my name is supposed to be stripped from that data, right? It's not supposed to be directly attached to it?
That is right. Unfortunately, it turns out that what is thought to be de-identified genetic information is actually fairly easy to trace back to an individual. Obviously, genetic information indicates whether it came from a male or a female. There are genetic variants in there that indicate ethnicity. There are other things, you know, hair color, skin color. And especially if you work for a small employer, let's say there's only 20 people there, it's not going to be very difficult to figure out who's who.
And how about if this information goes to an outside benefits management company, which I understand from your reporting is a pretty big business?
It's an $8 billion a year industry now. It's just the craziest thing. So these are so-called workplace wellness vendors. And there's some dispute about what laws cover them. But the majority of the employment attorneys I spoke to said that they are not subject to many of the privacy and other health information protection laws that are already on the books. And this would make them even less subject to those laws. And already, people who participate in the programs have been shocked to see after they fill out a questionnaire or have their blood drawn and tested, a few weeks later, they're getting pitches for, and not from the wellness company, but from an outside company who they've never heard of, they're getting pitches for, you know, let's say diapers, if they said, yes, they might want to become pregnant. They're getting pitches for running shoes, if they say that they jog a few, you know, hours per week or something. So their information is not only getting out, but it's being sold to third parties.
And apart from the privacy concerns, Sharon, you mentioned laws against discrimination based on genetics, but is that a concern down the road if a company or their health and wellness plan manager has somebody's genetic profile, sees some sort of genetic-linked predisposition to an illness, that could be an influence on who gets laid off, hired, fired?
Well, so certainly there would be lawsuits if that happened, but sometimes people can't get lawyers, and sometimes the, I guess we can call it discrimination, is not that overt. If the employer sees something in your genetic information that indicates you might be costing them a lot of money down the road, maybe you have a variant associated with stroke or cardiovascular disease, or you have the BRCA gene, which increases your risk of breast and ovarian cancer. You know, I mean, anyone who has been in the workforce for a while knows that employers have sort of discreet ways of letting you know that you're not a valued company employee, and whether that message is sent because they're afraid you might cost them down the road or because truly your work did not measure up, you know, that would be a really difficult thing to prove. So again, we'll kick it over to the lawyers.
As I mentioned, this bill made it through a House committee on a party line vote. Any indication of its trajectory in Congress now?
You know, Rob, some of the biggest groups in health and medicine have come out against it. The March of Dimes, the American Academy of Pediatrics, AARP. So they are letting their representatives know that this is absolutely not only unnecessary, but just an outrage and very bad for employees as well as for science. So now that it has seen the light of day, and as you mentioned at the top, this was sort of going through surreptitiously while everybody's attention was on the main repeal and replace law. Now that people have been awakened to what's going on, it's going to have certainly more difficulty. And in fact, over the weekend, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, said that the bill raises concerns. So that's the first peep we've had out of the administration. What effect that will have, again, we will see.
Sharon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Sharon Begley, senior science writer at STAT. She joined us to look at a bill making its way through Congress that would allow companies to penalize employees who don't provide genetic testing information to their employers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump has released an outline of his proposed budget. In it, he calls for large increases in defense and homeland security spending and steep cuts to domestic spending. He also wants to completely eliminate 19 federal agencies. We'll get the details. First, there's been a long-running debate over the role of money in American politics and an equally long battle in Congress and the courts over restrictions on political spending. Over the last handful of years, key U.S. Supreme Court decisions have opened the door to a lot more money flowing into the political arena, and the influence of donors was a key campaign theme for both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Our next guest comes at the issue of money in politics from a different angle, looking at who makes the donations, how they compare with the demographics of the public at large, and finding out how those differences can sway public policy. Mostly, he says, those differences pull politics in a more conservative direction. Sean McElwee joins us now. He's a policy analyst for the organization Demos, where he co-authored the report Whose Voice, Whose Choice? The Distorting Influence of the Political Donor Class in Our Big Money Elections. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's dive right into the differences you found when you looked at donation info. First of all, how do the donors compare with the public at large when it comes to wealth?
Yeah, so what we find is that when we're looking at very big donors, about half of them are millionaires. Those are people who are getting $10 or more. And that compares to about 3% of the population who are millionaires.
And then take us to race and gender. How does that stack up?
Absolutely. So when we are looking at, again, 10,000 or more donors, only 6% of donors are people of color, and people of color make up about a quarter of the adult population. And women make up about a third of donors giving $10,000 or more. So what we're seeing is that among the really big donors, they are much more likely to be white, male, and far, far more likely to have large amounts of wealth compared to the general public.
And do we see any difference between donors to Republican Party versus Democratic Party?
So we do find differences, but it's really important to note that both parties are drawing from a donor pool that is disproportionately white, disproportionately rich, and at the highest levels, disproportionately male. So Democrats do have far more female donors.
We're talking to Sean McElwee, policy analyst for the organization Demos. He's the co-author of the report, Whose Voice, Whose Choice? The Distorting Influence of the Political Donor Class on Our Big Money Elections. He's looking at differences between the public at large and the people who make the larger campaign donations in federal politics and how that affects ideology, policy. And Sean, let's get into that ideology. You started to look into some of the ideological differences on issues between donors and the public at large. And again, given that we see white men overrepresented there, what did you find?
Yeah, so when we're looking at elite donors, those are donors who are giving $5,000 or more. Their policy preferences align very well with Trump's budget. On a generic question of how would you balance the budget between cutting defense spending, cutting domestic spending, and raising taxes, the general population is about split, but 42% favor defense spending cuts and 42% favor defense spending cuts and 41% favor domestic spending cuts, and the rest say raise taxes. That compares to only 25% of elite donors who say cut defense spending. The plurality, 49%, say cut domestic spending. So the elite donors, the largest donors, are looking at Trump's budget, and they're not too disappointed.
And then you found that overall it sounds like Republican donors kind of pull their party more to the right than Democrats pull their party to the left. Do I have that right, and how does that work?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is we look particularly in 2010 when there were a lot of really important laws that were being passed. Democratic donors and voters are sort of agreed on these issues. There's overwhelming support for things like the stimulus package, the Affordable Care Act, SHIP expansion, Dodd-Frank. But But when we look at Republican donors and voters, we see a lot of differences. For example, a majority of Republican non-donors supported the expansion of the state children's health insurance program, whereas the vast majority of donors opposed that. Somewhat surprisingly, a majority of Republican non-donors also supported Dodd-Frank regulation of big banks, whereas, again, the Republican donors overwhelmingly opposed that.
So what do you make of that in politics? If the big donors who maybe have the ear of politicians are so much different in terms of demographics and in terms of ideology than the public at large?
Well, I think you're starting to see a lot of that in terms of both parties having candidates that are railing against the influence of big donors and the influence that big donors have had over the agenda. And you're starting to see more and more people are really disturbed about the disconnect between the people who are supposed to be leading them and their own views.
Do you see a pushback in the public from that? I mean, do you think these messages from Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, that obviously they had their successes, do you think that message was part of it?
Absolutely. I think it's really clear that the views among the general public that they are not being represented, while these really big interest groups and powerful donors are have the ear of Congress. And you can actually see both Obama and Chris Murphy talking about when they spend all of their time fundraising, it gives them a distorted view of the world in which, you know, marginal tax rates are more important than school lunches. And I think that's disturbing to a lot of Americans.
I want to throw this out to our callers, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you see big political donors having too much influence on politicians, on politics? Do you think that their agendas, even if it's, you know, the donors who are donating to the party you support, the Democratic donors if you're a Democrat, Republicans if you're a Republican, do they represent you? Do you think they should have the ear of the politicians that you're voting for? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Sean, when we talk about issues like campaign finance, and we've talked about those for a lot of years, you wrote in a piece about your report that a lot of times we look at this as a good government issue, kind of a civics issue. You say this is a policy issue, and it's an equality issue in some ways.
Yeah, so we argue that, and particularly we've actually done a series of studies on city-level campaign finance, and what we argue is that this should really be seen as a racial equity issue, as a gender equity issue, because wealthy people are certainly overrepresented, but white people are also overrepresented. And in the report, we discuss the literature that suggests pretty strongly that senators respond disproportionately to the preferences of their donors, to the preferences of voters, and certainly the preferences of their constituents. And that can lead to a lot of policy outcomes that have negative consequences across the board.
What do you see as a solution for people who see that as a problem? Is the solution to try to clamp down on money in politics, which is harder to do after Supreme Court decisions? Or is it to enable better communication between politicians and their non-wealthy constituents?
Yeah, so I think that there's three core solutions. I mean, first off, you're absolutely right. The Supreme Court is very important. We actually just released a report 2 days ago showing that 45% of the money spent in the 2016 election and about three-quarters of the money spent in competitive races was enabled by Supreme Court decisions like Buckley v. Valeo, like more recently Citizens United. So I think absolutely when we're talking about Supreme Court justices, we need to be talking more about money in politics. I think the second solution is more and more states and localities adopting public financing systems that can allow more candidates to run, have the ability to run, and spend more time directly interacting with their constituents. And the third, and I think this might strike a lot of people as surprising, but is higher voter turnout. When you have half of people voting in presidential elections, a third of people voting in midterm elections, and often single-digit turnout in local elections, politicians have more freedom to respond to donors. And we tend to see that the most influence donors can have is sort of on these issues that aren't really in the spotlight. And so having a more informed, engaged citizenry that is calling their representatives, that is turning out in sort of off-cycle elections and primary elections, is engaged, is something that will definitely threaten the power of donors. And we have actually seen a lot of literature suggesting that higher voter turnout can improve equity in policy, and that the people who call do actually have policies closer to those preferences.
Let's bring on a quick caller. We've got Richard on the line in Madison. Richard, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
So I think my comment is that when you have large donors that have the ability to fund campaigns in massive amounts, that it dilutes democracy dramatically. I think we should go back to the system where only individual donors can donate to candidates, and it should be a limited amount. I think that democracy is served to a much better extent.
Richard, thanks for the call. And as we wrap up, Sean, the idea, is there a disillusionment going on here, a cynicism that maybe the perception that donors have more influence is helping drive that voter turnout you were talking about, that low voter turnout you were talking about?
I think that's definitely a possibility. But what I would note is that, and I've written a report on this called Why Voting Matters, the best empirical research does suggest that voting is a mechanism that influences how politicians act. And I think particularly voting in elections where there's not a lot of turnout, that is a place where your vote is very important on the margins. And there are lots of ways that individuals and when people come together, they can have influence. And so I would say we should absolutely be concerned about the influence of money in politics, but we shouldn't give up our ability to make our voice heard in other ways.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Sean McLaughlin, policy analyst for the organization Demos, talking about the American political donor class. Coming up, a look at the outline of a budget from the Trump administration. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, the first African-American grandmaster details his unorthodox education and the private chess match that defines him. And a socialite trying to escape an unhappy marriage accidentally crashes the coronation of the King of Nepal. Those stories and more tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, President Trump today released a partial outline of his 2018 budget. The budget blueprint, which the administration calls an America First budget, calls for a $54 billion boost in military spending offset by deep cuts to domestic programs and foreign aid. Here's Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget, explaining the rationale for that budget.
I was elected to change our broken and dangerous system, and thinking in government that has weakened and endangered our country and left our people defenseless. And I will not stop fighting for the safety of you and your families, believe me. Not today, not ever.
Of course, Donald Trump there during the presidential campaign, his speech reflecting the budget priorities here. And I think we have Mick Mulvaney's quote now on the budget in particular.
Real simple. You had an American First candidate. You have an America First president. Now you have an America First budget. We're spending more money to defend the country, more money to enforce the laws, more money to secure the borders, more money to take care of our vets, more money for school choice, and less money for things like foreign aid. That's exactly what the president said he was going to do. That's what the budget is.
As Mulvaney said, the Department's Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security would all see increases in their budgets, but the State Department and agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, Health and Human Services, and the U.S. Agency for International Development would face significant cuts. With us now is Charlie Clark, senior correspondent for Government Executive Magazine and GovExec.com. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, spell out the broad strokes of this budget for us, if you would.
Well, $54 billion in cuts to defense would actually be about a 10% rise, since President Obama had already proposed about a $30 billion rise. And, of course, the Republicans never want to raise taxes in any way, so they want to offset that because of the Budget Control Act, they're required to come out even on defense versus domestic. They want to offset it with these pretty big cuts in the agencies, 31% for the Environmental Protection Agency, 28% for State Department and USAID. And there was 19 smaller agencies that would be completely eliminated under the budget, things like the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And in the interest of disclosure, that last one you mentioned would affect us here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Now let's put this budget proposal in context. This is a skinny budget, not all the details there. This is really a first step. Talk about what would happen between this and actually having a budget in place.
Yes, well, this is what happens whenever there's a new administration. They don't really have time to prepare the full budget, which is thousands of pages. But basically, it does not deal with the main drivers of federal spending, which are things like Social Security and Medicare and interest on the debt. This is what the critics call the automatic pilot programs. So, and it doesn't deal with the intake of tax revenues. The deficit would be about $488 billion under this plan, which is what the Congressional Budget Office projected for next year. So they, in their mind, it comes out as a wash, although they Mulvaney acknowledged that it does not balance, which is what his branch of the Republican Party would like to see done in the next 10 years. So the full budget will come out in May, and that's where they have to go through a lot of programs more line by line and make the macro numbers add up. And then you have the appropriations bills that are considered during the summer, and the fiscal year, fiscal 18, would start on October 1st. But there's going to be so much tension and resistance on Capitol Hill, and not just on a partisan basis, but from a regional basis as well, that it's possible that a lot of this budget will be considered dead on arrival, and it's also possible that you could have some kind of government shutdown in September if there's really a failure to agree.
Talking about the new skinny budget proposal, the first broad strokes of discretionary spending priorities from the Trump administration. Charlie Clark is with us from Government Executive Magazine. Charlie, let's look at some of the specific points here. You mentioned the defense budget increase, not as big as it looks when you compare it to other projected increases, still substantial. How do you think this would play in Congress?
Well, Senator McCain, who's chairman of the Armed Services Committee, put out a statement with his House counterpart, Matt Thornberry from Texas, saying that the defense number is still too small. They would like it to go up about another $30 billion. And they think we need to send troops, more troops into Afghanistan. And the Trump people are already considering a live proposal to send another 1,000 troops into Syria. The Pentagon has some weapon systems that they're ready to adjust upward, but they've been fighting to control it, and they've been under the sequestration threat for the last 5 years, and that has hampered their flexibility. But there's plenty of people over in the Pentagon who are ready to spend the money, which is a point that Mulvaney made yesterday.
And you mentioned Senator McCain and others wanting more of an increase. There are some other people saying, and not just Democrats, some Republicans too, I think, saying, well, we could use a little more fiscal discipline from the Pentagon. We don't audit these things enough. We don't look at weapon systems we may not need anymore. Is that going to be an argument when this hits Congress?
Yes. In fact, ironically, that was Mick Mulvaney's argument, and one of the reasons that Senator McCain did not vote for Mulvaney to be Trump's budget director, because 5 years ago and 3 years ago in a different situation, Mulvaney was instrumental in the government shutdown because he did not want to raise the defense spending because he wanted to contribute more towards reducing the federal debt, which is up to about $19 trillion.
Let's talk about the other department that'll see the biggest increases under, or would see them under this proposal. The Department of Homeland Security looks like a 6% increase, and that, of course, includes about $2.5 billion to begin work on the border wall that President Trump has been talking about since he became candidate Trump. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, you know that Trump people put out a fiscal 17 supplemental request today, too, which the fiscal 17 budget has to be finalized next month. And it includes $1.5 billion for this wall. So they really want to get going on the wall, even though conceptually the idea that Mexico would pay for it has sort of been abandoned. And there's plenty of Republicans who are still very skeptical about it and how you define the wall. Some people are pointing out now that some of it is more like a fence or an electronic surveillance, and it would be applied differently in different areas. There's a lot of eminent domain issues, the ranchers and other home property owners. They may have to, Trump has asked for some new money for attorneys who might try and use eminent domain to claim the land for the wall. So there's still a lot to be worked out there. The Homeland Security Department doesn't come out totally the way it might like. I mean, there are some cuts, I think, in Coast Guard and some reshuffling of some of its spending towards more of the border security and the law enforcement theme.
And then looking at some of the proposed cuts, the Environmental Protection Agency people pointing to a 31% proposed cut to the EPA. What were the arguments for doing that from the Trump administration?
Well, a lot of this is the Republicans do not believe that climate change is a serious issue. And they also think that too many of the Obama administration EPAs and previous EPAs cracked down on air pollution and water pollution were too burdensome on industry, and they've challenged a lot of it in court. Of course, Scott Pruitt, who's the new EPA administrator, was a attorney general in Oklahoma, and him personally challenged a lot of these in court. The EPA was the one agency mentioned in this budget with an exact figure for job cuts. 3,200 federal employees would lose. A lot of the I noticed that the Wisconsin Lakes Initiative, it was mentioned in your broadcast earlier. Well, there's also in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., there's the Chesapeake Bay, Save the Bay initiative that would also be eliminated. So it's there's a lot of debate still to be done between scientists and environmental activists and litigators in court before any of these cuts go all the way through. I don't think it's strictly going to be on a partisan basis. I think there's some regional differences there, too.
I was going to ask about that. You mentioned the regional pushback, and when you're talking about, say, EPA programs that focus on the Great Lakes region or the Chesapeake Bay region, is that something where you might see bipartisan pushback on that?
Yes. There's already a Virginia Congressman, Rob Whitman, who has said that he, even though he's a loyal Republican, that he can't sit idle while the Chesapeake Bay, Save the Bay initiative is abolished. And the same applies in public broadcasting, because there's a lot. I mean, this is a perennial for Republicans going back to the Newt Gingrich Congress in the 90s and also back in the 80s under Reagan, where the idea of abolishing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities doesn't strictly play on partisan lines, because in broadcasting, for example, the state of Maine, the state of Alaska, you have a lot of rural people who may be conservative Republican voters but who depend on public broadcasting. So the idea that it's all for a bunch of liberals, I think, is a little bit exaggerated. And some people may argue the same thing with the two endowments. You know, they sort of support a lot of highbrow urban art and scholarly pursuits in the humanities, you know, the papers of the First Continental Congress or something. And it's not something that maybe average people are paying much attention to, but they also make the argument that at $148 million a year, those two endowments are pittance in compared with the larger budget. But the basic clash is that the Republicans begin with the assumption that no taxes can be raised. So that's the Democrats will fight to preserve the 2011 Budget Control Act balance between domestic and defense spending, and their argument would be that, yeah, if you want new spending on defense, then you have to raise taxes for it, and you have to raise domestic spending equally. But of course, the Democrats are in the minority now, and this is in a new era where we have Republicans controlling the White House as well as both chambers of Congress.
We're talking to Charlie Clark, senior correspondent at Government Executive Magazine, about the Trump administration's budget blueprint unveiled today. I want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1110. 1234. What do you make of what you've seen in this budget proposal? Do you agree that the country should boost its defense and homeland security spending, or cut funding to agencies that oversee things like environment, health, agriculture, and labor, among others? Or would you like to see different priorities? How about taxes? Would you like them to see them stay where they are, get cut, go up to pay for some of these priorities? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our analysis of the Trump administration's budget blueprint, which calls for a big increase in defense spending and significant decreases to the State Department and the Environmental Protection Agency, also eliminating 19 government agencies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Which parts of this budget outline are you agreeing with? Which parts are you worried about? What do you think about the proposal to eliminate 19 government agencies, thousands of federal jobs, and who do you see as the winners and losers in this budget outline? Call in at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Charlie Clark stays with us. He's senior correspondent for Government Executive Magazine and GovExec.com. Before we go to our callers, Charlie, let's talk about that so-called entitlement issue, the Social Security, the Medicare. This is a tough thing to tackle. People have been talking about trying to make changes there. It's pretty hard to do, though, isn't it?
Yes. Well, both the Medicare and the Social Security trust funds are in danger of becoming insolvent, but it's decades away, and the Affordable Care Act, which the Republicans are trying to repeal now, prolong the life of the Medicare fund for a while. But the other complication is that Trump is on the record in many video clips promising that Social Security and Medicare will not be touched because people have earned it. It's a little different from a handout program because a lot of people have paid their own. I mean, most adult working Americans have paid their own money into it. So Paul Ryan from your home state does not quite see it that way. And his early budgets in 2011 and 13 had plenty of efforts to try and reform Social Security and Medicare, and they say to preserve it for the long run. But a lot of the critics say it really means cutting people's monthly benefits to some extent.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Cindy on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. I'm just disgusted with this whole budget. I mean, Trump said he was going, when he was candidate, he said if he won, he was going to put America first and be a president for all Americans. Yet he's talking about cutting all these domestic programs. And, I mean, if he adds to the war budget or the defense budget, most of that goes over to other countries anyway. It doesn't stay here. So I just don't understand how he can talk these talks and then do completely the opposite once he's in office.
Cindy, thanks for the call. I mean, that's, I guess, your interpretation of America first. But, Charlie, President Trump, he's doing things he had talked about during the campaign, isn't he?
Yes. To the extent that the average voter really knows about the budget and has an opinion on some of these lesser-known agencies, of course, is questionable. But foreign aid has never been popular among the American voters because it does feel like it's going to somebody else that they'll never meet. But the people who run the Pentagon and the State Department agree that foreign aid is an important tool. It helps avoid wars. It helps develop countries that become our trading partners and prevent hotspots from flaring up around the world. That's the theory of it anyway. So it's less than 1% of the budget, and I think there's been polls showing that the average American thinks that it's a much higher percentage of the budget than it really is.
Thanks for the call. Cindy, we'll go next to Lee in Madison. Lee, hi.
Hi. Why don't we start looking at corporate entitlements, cut those first, and then we could start looking at maybe some of the domestic or the entitlements or some other things in the budget. But our corporate entitlements are just, I mean, what's General Electric have a negative 300% tax rate or doling out money to Shell? What do they get, up $1.5 billion a year in corporate incentives and entitlements?
Lee, thanks for the call. Charlie, is there that much money out there in money that is either given in some subsidy form to corporations or tax cuts or loopholes, if people want to call them that, that we could be more than a drop in the bucket?
People on the left do criticize what what they call corporate welfare, people on the right, too. I mean, a good example of that is the Export-Import Bank of the United States, which helps foreign governments buy American-made aircraft from Boeing, for example. So Boeing and Lockheed are very much backers of the Export-Import Bank, but it gets attacked from the right and the left as being a corporate subsidy. I will mention that among these 19 agencies that the Trump people would like to abolish is the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is an independent banking agency of sorts that also lends money to developing countries to help boost their trade prospects. And some people might argue that that's corporate welfare, too, but there's a counterargument.
Thanks a lot for that call. Want to get into some programs aimed at helping lower-income Americans. The LIHEAP, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, helps people pay utility bills and weatherize homes. Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, as the local officials like to call it, part of Housing and Urban Development, helps support affordable housing. They're on the chopping block, it looks like.
Yeah, the a lot of the states and governors, we have a lot of Republican governors, of course, and they say they want flexibility, but they also want the federal money. And it's the community development block grants do go toward the sort of less visible programs for the low income people, and who don't have their own lobby that's very powerful in Washington. So again, this is sort of a natural target, and there's other programs within HUD too that that Ben Carson, the new secretary there, has helped nominate, which the tenants groups and affordable housing people and the people who work with the homeless are not happy with some of those proposals.
Let's bring on another caller. We've got Becky on the line in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hi, that was a great segue for my question. I work at the public library here in Beloit, and we help a lot of those lower-income people that you were just talking about. And my question is, will public libraries be affected by this? I can't possibly understand the intricacies of this, but we're already on a really tight budget, and, you know, we're really trying to help people in our community. I just wonder what effects this will have on public libraries.
Well, one of the 19 agencies that would be abolished is the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Now, they don't fund the base budgets of local libraries, but they do give a lot of important grants. And, you know, there's all sorts of building construction and money that if there was an infrastructure program, which the Trump people claim is their third priority, the first priority is health care reform, the second is tax reform, and the third is going to be infrastructure, they say, maybe there would be some infrastructure projects that would help the library community. But the thing is that depending on the state you live in, local funding may be rising or falling for libraries, independent of what happens in Washington. I think the Trump people believe that the mood in the country is for less government, with the exception being defense and defense against terrorism, and that is debatable. We'll see how the polls react to some of these proposals and how the average voters, especially the ones in rural areas who voted for Trump, react to some of these proposals to kill programs over the next couple of weeks.
We'll leave it there for now. Charlie, thanks a lot for spending this time with us today.
Happy to do it. Yeah.
We've been talking to Charlie Clark, senior correspondent for Government Executive Magazine and GovExec.com, looking at this first step in a big, long budget process, the so-called skinny budget released by the Trump administration. Still time to share your thoughts, concerns, and hopes for the budget over at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.